from KQED.
This is the California Report. Good morning. I'm John Sepulveda, and we begin in Berkeley, where on Saturday, a pro-President Trump rally organized by white nationalists resulted in at least 20 arrests and 30 people injured. The rally was advertised locally as a, quote, Patriot Day in support of President Trump, but both participants and Berkeley police confirmed it was organized by a local white nationalist group. The organizing group threw tear gas against the counter-protesting leftist group Antifa, who in turn started pit fights and threw M80 firecrackers into the crowd. Both groups came ready to riot. They wore masks to hide their identities and were armed with small explosives, clubs, rocks, and helmets. The right-wing paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, came to assist the nationalists. At one point, the two groups violently fought over which side could push a dumpster, yes, a dumpster, down the street, as police in riot gear watched from the sides. Federal judge in San Francisco says he'll soon rule on whether to block President Trump's plan to defund cities, counties, and states with sanctuary policies. KQED's Julie Small reports.
Attorneys for San Francisco and Santa Clara counties told U.S. District Judge William Orrick they face significant funding cuts, about $2 billion each, under the president's executive order on immigration. The counties both have a policy not to honor detainer requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's when ICE asks local authorities to hold undocumented inmates after they've served their time so they can be deported. Acting Assistant U.S. Attorney General Chad Riedler told the judge that the lawsuits are premature because the counties haven't suffered any harm, nor will they. But San Francisco Deputy City Attorney Molly Lee argued that position is inconsistent with President Trump's repeated threats against communities that don't honor ICE detainers.
San Francisco is not going to be bullied by President Trump.
The counties want a national injunction against the executive order.
We remain committed to our sanctuary city policies. And we are going to continue to litigate this as long as we need to ensure that these unconstitutional threats are not applied against San Francisco or any jurisdiction in the country.
During the hearing, Judge Orrick said he was inclined to agree that San Francisco and Santa Clara counties are harmed by the president's order. For the California Report, I'm Julie Small.
We're going to move on now. About a month ago, we told you about more than 700 companies, many from California, that submitted bids to build President Trump's border wall. Now, Los Angeles County State Senator Ricardo Lara has introduced a bill that would bar any contractor who works on that wall from getting State of California contracts.
A wall will hurt our economy, will devastate our environment down in Southern California, and would have a tremendous negative impact on our border region, which is one of the most busiest borders in the world.
And it should be noted there is already a border fence that in most places is 20 feet high and made of steel. Let's move now to Monterey County and spend some time focused on two significant injuries that occurred during last year's Sabranas wildfire. Both of the men who were injured were fighting the fire. One man lost his life. Experts say it has shined a light on the dangers of what we're going to call the wildfire gig economy. KQED's Ted Goldberg has been looking into this issue, and he joins me now. Good morning, Ted.
Morning.
One of the things you found is that workers from all over California get called in for jobs at a moment's notice, but they don't have some of the basic protections that staff firefighters do. What does that mean?
So, for instance, Robert Reagan, the bulldozer operator who died in the Sabranas fire in July, was called to an area that was just like you described. It was actually in the middle of the night. And as he was using his bulldozer to drive a fire line, he was blocked by another vehicle. He had to back up, and eventually his massive machine basically flipped down a hillside. He flew out of it, and the bulldozer pinned him to the ground, crushed him, and he died. Now, another incident that took place several months later involved a water tender driver who survived. John Tiersma was driving a massive water tanker. As he was driving, the road underneath him gave way. I spoke to him from his home in Dunsmuir. He told me what happened.
Stuff was just flying around. Dirt was coming in. I thought I was goner. And I prayed to God to deliver me, and he did.
That crash broke or cracked 12 of his ribs, bruised his spleen, and broke his scapula. He had blood in his lungs, and one lung had a leak into his chest cavity. Mm. Now, what we learn in looking into both of these cases is that both of these men were private contractors who worked for small companies who didn't have workers' compensation insurance. Without that insurance, John Tiersma, the man whose voice you just heard, has had trouble paying for his medical bills, which you could see cost quite a lot of money, yeah. And the relatives of the bulldozer operator who died are left having trouble getting any compensation from his death.
These men who are operating the water truck and the bulldozer and other workers like them, are they doing this full time? Or is this really truly a kind of gig thing where they get called in the middle of the night, they go and do this, and the work is real hit and miss and real spotty?
I think it's really hit and miss. For instance, the documents that we got from Cal OSHA actually show a string of text messages between Ian Zerbin, the guy who runs Zerbin Concrete Construction, and who's believed to be his friend, Robert Reagan. And it's basically very casual language. Hey, bro, I need some help. Can you come over and work on this fire with me? And the guy, Robert Reagan, checks, no, I'm not working a fire right now. I can go. And this sort of dynamic takes place all fire season long and every year. These folks, as I mentioned before, John Tiersma comes from Dunsmuir, and he had worked other large fires in other places of the state. So they move from all over, and they do get brought in at a moment's notice.
So it seems like if you are one of these gig operators and somebody texts you and says, hey, bro, need help, you need to text back and say, hey, bro, got workers' comp insurance?
I think there's an argument to be made that nobody is taking responsibility for both of these men and both of their families. Cal Fire, Cal OSHA, the state, they point to this small independent firm and say, it's your responsibility. You should have had workers' compensation. It's your fault that you didn't make sure that Robert Reagan was wearing a seatbelt. At the same time, this is a massive state government. If a small firm doesn't have the kind of benefits that it should for one of its employees, I think there's an argument to be made that the state should consider filling that gap.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because earlier in this program, we heard from Senator Ricardo Lara of Los Angeles, who said he's going to do everything he can to keep people who work on the border wall from contracting with California. It seems like before they start worrying about that, they should really be working to make sure that they can do everything they can, that if a company, like you just said, may not have workers' comp insurance, is not contracting with the state of California first.
There are tons of people at Cal Fire, and I would assume so at the U.S. Forest Service, who deal in the massive amount of paperwork that this involves. I looked at Serban's application. I looked at all of his insurance documentation, and it is a lot. And if you multiply that by the number of contractors that these agencies deal with on an annual basis, I can understand how something as small as an insurance compensation policy expiring might fall through the cracks. It's just not something that is aggressively sought after. They rely on the private sector to basically police itself.
As they do in so many other regulatory capacities. Ted Goldberg, outstanding investigative work. You can find it at kqed.org. Ted, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears now and talk trash with KQED science reporter Lindsay Hoshaw. It's time for Trash Talk. Lindsay, today we're going to talk about trash past, present, and future. What you got for us?
Well, this week, like you said, we're talking about the history of trash. And before the 20th century, before the Industrial Revolution, people just threw their trash wherever they wanted. They threw them in rivers and alleyways and streets, and it created filthy conditions, and spreading disease was one of the big problems. So landfills were actually created a lot later to stop the spread of disease, not just try to contain all this muck.
So the idea was, in essence, to quarantine the trash and all the disease that goes with it.
Yeah, and try to organize it, because initially there were no garbage men or garbage collectors. It was just every person for themselves throwing it wherever they could. The first landfill was created in Fresno, California in 1937. It was the first sanitary landfill, so the first modern-day landfill that had liners on the bottom to prevent the spread and
leak. The seepage of
toxic material into the groundwater.
Huh. Well, what we're filling in those landfills, whether they're in Fresno or other places, is also changing. And you gave me the example before we came in of milk bottles. Tell everyone what you meant by that.
So milk bottles were actually first introduced in the U.S. in 1879. And for a long time, you had milkmen that would come by and deliver milk to your doorsteps. And the good thing about these is that they came in glass bottles and they could be recycled. So they went to recycling centers or they were taken back to the manufacturer and they were reused over and over again. Not like today, where the milk jugs you get in the grocery store, for the most part, are in plastic containers.
speaking of single use, before we go, you were telling me about somebody who has refuse remorse. Tell us a little bit about this guy who, what did he invent again?
The Keurig coffee pod.
Ah, yes.
Also known as the K-cup.
Yes.
So you may know of these. They were first invented for offices. A lot of people have them at home now. But the inventor of Keurig coffee pod has said he kind of regrets making them. There have been over 8 billion of these little coffee pods produced.
Holy moly.
And in 2014, at least, when they looked at how many had been produced, if they lined them up around the world, they would wrap around the earth 10 times. And so he's even said he doesn't use Keurig coffee pod. He thinks drip coffee is fine. And it's this unintended consequence that he had just never envisioned before. Mm.
Lindsay Hoja joins us each week to talk trash. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2018 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
In just a few minutes on Forum, we're going to talk about the Berkeley protests that happened this weekend. In the meantime, this has been the California Report for Monday, April 17th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm John Sepulvedo. Have a great day.